From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. How will you know when the end is near? It seems these days there's an apocalypse around every corner.
But if you did believe E-Bible Fellowship, you can't be too surprised. Though their pamphlet says that October 7th, 2015 will be the end of the world, they hedge their bets a bit by adding, there's a strong likelihood. Yeah, strong likelihood. It might happen, but if it doesn't, not like it's the end of the world.
One safe bet to make before the end of the world, people will continue to lose their minds over Beyonce.
All that you need to know is that Queen Bee is back. She's back to Sting. She's back to Slade. She's back to make these hoes their servants.
We'll talk about Doomsday and Bay this hour. First, though, let's return to a conversation we had last week. It was about places in Georgia that restrict certain breeds of dogs, mostly pit bulls at this point. We spoke with Emily Patterson Kane. She's animal welfare scientist at the American Veterinary Medical Association.
When you're trying to tie temperament to a breed, there's going to be a very wide range of temperament in that breed. So trying to predict the temperament of an individual animal is always an inexact science.
Here are your first thoughts. Mariah Medina reached us on Facebook. Quote, we have 98 pounds Rottweiler. To look at her is very intimidating, but the boss of our house is the Jack Russell. Fear of dog breeds come and go. First it was the German Shepherd, then the Doberman, then the Rottweiler, and now the Pit Bull. If a person wants a vicious dog and they can't get a Pit Bull, they'll just find another breed. And Jamie Penderson writes this, I've fostered over 150 dogs in the last several years. I've been bit by more Chihuahuas than pit mixes. We always want to know what you think. We're at facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. We're also on Twitter at OSD Talk, or just call us and leave a message. It's 404-500-9457, and we might feature your comments on the show. Tucked away in the northeast corner of Georgia is the town of Elberton. It's mostly known for being the granite capital of the world. But the most unique rock structure found there is a 19-foot monument that contains guidance for life after the apocalypse, whether that be caused by war, plague, or zombies.
We do what we need to do, and then we get to live. Because this is how we survive. We tell ourselves that we are the walking dead.
The structure is known as the Georgia Guidestones, and it's been likened to a stateside version of Stonehenge just because it's large, it's heavy, and it's made of rock, and it's also mysterious. Travel writer Shannon Dell visited the stones for BBC Travel, and she joins us now to talk about them. Hi, Shannon.
Hi, how are you?
First, let's get a picture in our heads of what this looks like. Can you describe the Georgia Guidestones for me?
Well, they are massive. They're about 19 feet tall. It's a six-piece monument, and the five pieces are connected with one capstone on top.
And kind of like a, I don't know, a sun shape, right?
Yes,
there's a center,
yeah, yeah.
And they're kind of radiating out.
Yes, yeah, and they're aligned with the North Star, the celestial poles, the sun solstices and equinoxes, and yeah.
Yeah, it's all kinds of astronomic features, which we can go into in a moment. But the most interesting thing about them is the writing that's on them. And it's in a number of different languages. We not only have the modern languages in which all the instructions are written, but then you have four ancient languages inscribed across the top of the structure. And I mean Babylonian, classic Greek, Hindi, and there's even some hieroglyphs in there. But we've translated everything, have we not?
Yes, the capstone says in the four ancient languages, let these be guidestones to an age of reason. And do you want me to read the...
No, because those are very long.
Yes, they are very long.
They are very long, but they say they have these a set of 10 guidelines, I guess, or principles.
Yes.
And things like maintain humanity under 500 million to be in perpetual balance with nature. And this is kind of why people think they're apocalyptic. Take a listen here.
The most ominous guideline reads, quote, maintain humanity under 500 million in perpetual balance with nature, a figure which, of course, couldn't possibly be achieved without either mass genocide or draconian and long-lasting programs of population control, even more extreme than the one-child policy in China.
That is Paul Joseph Watson speaking there. He's an editor and writer for Infowars.com. Is that the only reason people think these guidestones are instructions for survival of the apocalypse?
Well, let's see. I mean, basically it's just instructions for rebuilding society. So there's tons and tons of other things that they say, you know, guide reproduction wisely. We need to have a one living language. We need to unite the entire world with one language. We need to with unjust laws and unjust courts. We also, one of the most interesting things to me is it says, let all nations rule in resolving external disputes in a world court.
Let me repeat that because you dropped out right in the middle. Let all nations rule internally resolving external disputes in a world court. Why does that interest you?
Well, just kind of like a new world order that they want this one ruler to reign over everybody. They want one world court. They want one language.
Now, here's the reason why they're mysterious, is that we don't know who put them up. We know that somebody commissioned a company to erect them there. But do we really not? Isn't this an age where you can kind of find out everything? Do we really not know who put these up, who funded these?
As far as everybody that I've talked to, even if they know, nobody's speaking. he came under the R.C. Christian.
Right, the name R.C. Christian, which is probably a pseudonym.
Yes.
And they've been there since 1980.
Yes.
Which should be plenty of time for someone to leak something.
Right.
But they haven't.
They haven't.
So who owns these?
I'm pretty sure the person who owns the land owns the Guidestone.
Which is like a farmland.
Yeah, it's just a farmland in the middle of nowhere. It's on a big, desolate hill. There's nothing else around it.
Now, one of the things which is a little bit controversial is that there's there's another message, a tablet that's set aside from it that Senate kind of describes the Guidestones. And as I understand it, I've not been out to visit these yet, but you have. As I understand it, the tablet actually misspells a bunch of things and incorrectly uses words, which has made people think maybe the tablet was created by somebody different than the person who created the Guidestones.
I haven't heard anything about that. What interests me about the explanation stone, it's a few yards away from the monument. It's a time capsule, but it has the day that it was placed, but no date to open it. So that's what intrigues me about it.
So, and we know for sure that there's a time capsule buried there? Have we?
No, nobody knows anything really about the guys. That's what makes it so mysterious. But, you know, because nobody has dug it up. But it says that it's a time capsule, does not give a date to open it, and it also explains all the astrological placement of the stones and everything.
Which are very interesting. The channel that goes through the stone shows where the celestial pole is, and the horizontal slot indicates the travel of the sun per year. There's all kinds of lunar declination cycles. So whomever installed it, it was very, very carefully placed.
Right, yes.
But what about the conspiracy theories? Did you look into any of those? Because there was at least one activist who said they were satanic and wanted to have them torn down. Did you find anything out about those conspiracy theories?
Yeah. So whenever the stones were unveiled on March 22nd, 1980, there was about a crowd of 100 people. There was a preacher there that automatically made the link to Stonehenge, which, you know, Stonehenge has a
makes
lot
sense,
of
yeah.
sacrificial backgrounds to it. And so he was saying it was the work of the devil. And so that kind of got a lot of people thinking, like, oh, this is where people are going to sacrifice one another. So that's one conspiracy theory. There is also another one, which when I was at the Stones, I talked to somebody who was visiting on his way through to another roadside oddity down in Florida. And he was saying that Christian was a part of the Rosicrucian Order, which is a community that studies the metaphysical law of the universe. And he believes that Christian was given the elixir of life.
And when you say Christian, you mean R.C. Christian, the name of the person
yes.
who supposedly put these up. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And so he thinks that he was given the elixir of life and that the Rosicrucian order believes that he knows all the secrets of the universe and that he's somewhere out there just doing his thing, whatever that may be.
But we don't really honestly know who put these up, but they are built to last. They're not going anywhere.
Oh, they're not going anywhere. And when I talked to some of the locals in the town, they're pretty much the general idea that he chose Elberton because of the massive amount of granite that exists under the town. It's a granite deposit that's 35 miles long, 6 miles wide, and 3 miles deep. So if there's going to be a natural disaster like an earthquake, Elberton is going to be fine. So as far as rebuilding society, R.C. Christian picked Elberton because he knew that if there was a natural disaster, people would probably survive in Elberton.
And he or she wanted to make sure people could see it from a long way coming. It's at the highest point in Elbert County,
yeah.
And you can actually see it from the Georgia Highway 77 as you're coming in.
Yep.
So, I mean, I have to ask you, Shannon, what your thoughts are on this. When you see these guidelines, avoid petty laws and useless officials, prize truth, beauty, and love, what do you take away from this? Are these doomsday instructions?
Yeah, I think so. I like about half of them, and the other half I've got a big problem with.
Oh, wait, what's the one you have a big problem with?
Well, they maintain humanity under 500 million. What happens if you're the one person of 5 million? I don't agree.
Oh, if you're 500 million and one.
Yeah, what happens if you're that one person? I mean, it's so vague. Is there leeway in these laws? Are these strict laws? We don't know. As far as the be not a cancer on the earth, leave room for nature, I love that. I think that's amazing. But then you've got, and the protect the people and nations with fair laws, I like that. Passion, faith, and tradition, and all things with tempered reason, I like that. But then, I don't like the whole maintain humanity. I don't like the guide reproduction wisely or the have one giant language, stuff like that.
Which should be a new language. You didn't specify if it's Klingon or not.
Right, exactly. Which, that would be cool. I could get behind that.
You could? Well, I mean, would you suggest, is it a kind of thing that you would suggest people go and see? You are a travel writer after all.
Oh, yeah, definitely go and see it. It's weird. It's got an energy to it. It's got a very, whether you think it's satanic or you think that it's amazing or you're just stopping through, it definitely has feeling to it. And it is very, very eerie, especially if you're by yourself up there. But it is absolutely something worth seeing, especially just in this little town in Georgia, which you wouldn't expect to see anything spectacular like that. But, there it is up on a hill. It is really something.
Okay, so go but take a friend.
Shannon Tell. Yeah, go and take a friend.
She's a travel writer. Her work has been featured by BBC Travel. Shannon, it's a pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm so possessive, so I rock his rock necklaces. My daddy Alabama, mama Louisiana. You mix that Negro with that Creole, make a Texas Bama. I like my baby hair with baby hair and afro. I like my Negro nose with Jackson 5 nostrils. I earned all this money, but they never take the country out me. I got hot sauce in my bag. Swag.
Just in case you haven't seen the video for Beyoncé's new song, Formation, here's a quick visual summary. It begins with a singer on top of a sinking New Orleans police car. There are images of unrest in Ferguson. There's graffiti that says, "Stop shooting us," and a young boy who dances in front of a line of police officers in riot gear with their hands up. All the while, Beyoncé, of course, singing and executing some perfect choreography along with a line of backup dancers. That video and the singer's performance of the song at the Super Bowl halftime show have revealed some pretty deep divisions that go deeper than just black and white. And we wanted to go beyond, beneath, and behind that conversation. So I've invited four guests to help us understand what's really going on here and if it's worth so much discussion. Regina Bradley teaches at Armstrong State University in Savannah. Right now, though, she's at Harvard University, where she is a hip-hop fellow, which I'm very interested to know what that is, Regina. A hip-hop fellow. Hi.
Round three. Ding, ding.
Yeah. So what is a hip-hop fellow?
So I'm one of the Nazir Jones hip-hop fellows at the Harvard Hip-Hop Archive Institute, which means that I've been selected to work on a project that helps to continue the legacy, not necessarily of Nazir Jones and kind of having this innovative project, research project. So what I'm working on
currently is... Nazir Jones as in Nas.
Nas.
The rapper. Yeah.
They gave his full government name, Nazir Jones. So I'm up here trying to finish my first book project on how hip-hop helps us think about black folks in the South after the Civil Rights Movement.
Interesting. I imagine that will come up. Also joining us again is Arielle Marie. She started the Atlanta-based activist organization It's Bigger Than You. Welcome back, Arielle.
Thank you for having me back. Thank you so much.
And with us from Cornell University is J. Michael Kinsey. He is originally from East Point, Georgia, but is at Cornell working on his PhD in theater and putting together a one-man show about masculinity in black and queer communities. Hi, J. Michael.
Good morning. Good morning.
And on the line from California is a freelance journalist, Kate Forrestal, who's written about the issue we're about to discuss. Hi, Kate.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for getting up early for us.
Sure.
We're going to be talking a lot about what's inside, the lyrics that are inside Beyoncé's song. But I wanted to begin with one of the most common complaints, which is that the song itself didn't belong in the Super Bowl. So let's take a listen here. This is ABC's The View, and co-host Paula Ferris said Beyoncé's song is too political for the game.
I'm not comfortable when my pastor talks about politics. I don't want politics at the podium. I don't want them, you know, at the pulpit. I just think there's a time and a place. I think she has a strong message in her new video. That's great. But when you have a Super Bowl performance or you're accepting a speech or my pastor's preaching about Jesus, like I think it can make some people uncomfortable.
Regina, can we start there with whether it was appropriate?
Yes. It was appropriate. I'm not. So let me give my disclaimers first. I'm not a Beyoncé stan. I'm not a member of the Beehive. But I do feel like it was appropriate because we've been fighting so long to actually have these types of conversations. And why not use one of the biggest platforms in pop culture and sports to do that? There were other messages on the Super Bowl, too. Let's make it clear. I mean, Coldplay came out for gay rights. It was a big rainbow before you got to Beyoncé getting in formation, which was, you know, somewhat appropriate considering that they were in San Francisco. but I really think it was appropriate considering that she was forcing an issue. She was using her platform to force an issue to make us to recognize the fact that we are having these conversations on the margins, but we need to bring them more to the forefront because black folks protesting and black folks saying they matter is important, but we're not going to get anything done unless we have two sides to the conversation. And I think that she used her platform to do it. It was very much calculated, which I said in both my Washington Post op-ed as well as in the blog that I wrote. And it was calculated. It wasn't just randomly, hey, I'm going to dress up as a Black Panther in Northern California on the 50th anniversary of the Black Panther Party.
Well, let's take this to J. Michael, because there has been other, complaints about inappropriateness at other times. At the Olympics, when two athletes held their fists up quite some time ago, there have been complaints about this a number of times. Any time, even in Oscar acceptance speeches, when people talk about political unrest that's going on, is it appropriate to bring up political issues and social activism at events like the Super Bowl or even award shows?
It's absolutely important to do that in that space. I think for me, my problem is that even in the language of the quote that you use, the person saying that there shouldn't be politics in the pulpit, politics here, she spoke about the video. The video was not depicted at the Super Bowl. What we did see was girls in booty shorts twerking, saying slay. And for me, I'm trying to understand, where is the activism in that, especially in this heated racial climate that we are in right now in America? For me, I didn't get activism from Beyonce's song. I didn't get really empowerment. And I was just really confused that everybody felt. I mean, I understand the Black Panthers are important. I understand that the commemoration of the 50 years of the Black Panthers is important. For me, it was not explicit. And in this time, I feel like we need explicit activism. And what Beyonce was doing for me is not activism.
Okay. But let me bring that then to you, Kate Forrestal, because one of the things you argued in your piece was that Beyonce's song and her performance isn't for someone like you. You are white. And maybe that's why, correct me if I'm wrong, maybe that's why some people felt it was inappropriate that she was doing a song that was targeting one specific demographic. Does that have any merit?
Well, I could only hope. I completely agree with Dr. Bradley. I could only hope that it would be targeting much more than one demographic. I think that we're in a place where, particularly at the Super Bowl, I thought it was a perfectly appropriate place to do it. My first job out of college was working for an NFL team. And, you know, there are how many black men on the field? And I think it's perfectly appropriate that a black woman was the sort of crowning moment of that Super Bowl. I think it was very calculated, and I think making people uncomfortable is not a bad thing. I actually am friends with one of Dr. Bradley's friends. Dr. Zandria Robinson is part of a project that I am doing, and I was at her house one night with her and her husband for dinner, and I just blurted out, I have to make myself uncomfortable, and then realized that that should be kind of the mantra of this project. If white people don't make themselves uncomfortable by stepping to the sidelines, by listening, nothing is going to get solved. I mean, so I'll get off my soapbox now, but I completely think it was absolutely appropriate what she did.
Celeste, can I speak to the previous comment about activism just real quick? I really feel like we can't use traditional models of activism because those traditional models are outdated. There's so many different ways to be an activist. If I like to twerk, if I like to have on a quote-unquote skimpy outfit, that shouldn't negate the fact that I'm doing something that is forcing an issue that otherwise would not be put into the forefront of the Super Bowl or at the forefront of even the Grammys, because it's not in a traditional form of activism dress. And I find that slightly problematic. And it takes away from the fact that there are multiple, just like there's multiple types of black folks, multiple types of black experiences. There's also multiple types of activism. And those activism forms might not please everybody. They might not work similarly in all spaces, but we have to, in order to progress the issue, we have to acknowledge and accept the fact that this activism thing is messy in the 21st century. And I think
it's always messy.
Yeah, I mean, but it's like especially messy now because you have social media. You know what I'm saying? And social media as like an additional fourth wall, if you will, that we didn't have during the 1950s and 1960s. And I think that because folks are actually being able to peek through that wall, it's making, we're getting people uncomfortable, but before we even can get to the issue at hand because of the way that it's packaged.
Okay, let's address then another criticism of what was in there and kind of try to broaden it out to other activist movements. So there was a complaint from Mayor Rudy Giuliani. He wasn't the only one, though, former New York City mayor. And he said that the performance was inappropriate mainly because it was too critical of police. Here he is on Fox News.
And I thought it was really outrageous that that she used it as a platform to attack police officers, who are the people who protect her and protect us and keep us alive. And what we should be doing in the African-American community and all communities is build up respect for police officers.
So, Regina, now this is, I think, a legitimate issue, whether you agree with him or not, in terms of how one crafts a message to make sure that that message says exactly what you want it to say and not what you don't want it to say.
Exactly.
Do you understand what I mean? Is there...
If
an anti-police message?
Yeah, I would love Ariel, because I feel like this is your lane, Shouty. This is you.
So I just wanted to, I think this runs in tandem with a point that was made earlier about the comfort of white folks in the necessity of this, you know, the universality, if you will, of Beyonce's message. And I just wanted to say earlier, I remember hearing a point about, you know, being uncomfortable in the wake of Formation. And I think we have to remember that, like, white folks and white supremacy never wants to be comfortable when confronted with these issues. I mean, never wants to be uncomfortable. And so we shouldn't romanticize the discomfort of Black people and Brown people in a anti-Black racist society. I can't for a minute imagine that Tamir Rice was comfortable being shot. I can't imagine that
Tamir Rice was the young boy that was shot by police seconds after the police officer got out of his car. Go ahead.
And I can't imagine that Michael Brown, who was shot by Officer Darren Wilson in Ferguson, was comfortable being displayed after being executed for 4 hours in the streets of Ferguson. And so when we're talking about these issues around the value of Black lives, of course there's going to be discomfort because we are disturbing the normalcy of white supremacy. And so Beyonce took what was a comfortable setting, the Super Bowl is, you know, America's greatest pastime, and disturbed the surface of the pool. And for that fact, if no other, it is an active form of resistance against the system. And so then using her platform to bring in the visual and metaphorical resistance against police brutality. She had a young Black boy in a hoodie dancing in front of police officers on the birthday of Trayvon Martin, who was killed in a hoodie. I think these are all important intentional things, these relics of our past.
Let me bring you in back into this, Kate, because we got a tweet from @POTUSOTUS, who says, people want to enjoy Black music without hearing about their struggle. Hashtag get information. Mm-hmm. Kate, what's your response to that?
Oh, I completely agree. I think that was the point of my the piece that I wrote, which, given my history, I imagine the same 15 people would read it who've read everything else I've ever written. I had no idea it would resonate, but I completely agree, and it's why I said, you know, this song, Kendrick Lamar's All Right, we cannot know the struggle. It's just time to stop using words as if they're just the next pop song. I think it's really critical that we listen to the struggle. We hear the whole story. And that's going to make us it's going to make people defensive, it's going to make people angry, and it's going to make them uncomfortable. I am still waiting for an explanation.
This is why I was actually exactly saying that, you know, we need explicit. I don't have a problem with Beyonce's attire, and I think that that is an easy argument to go that activism looks like something different now. Yes, it surely does, but we need explicit activism where I really understand exactly what you're saying, which is why Janet Jackson came out with a video right after this situation. She came out with a video commemorating Black Lives Matter. That's why Kendrick Lamar's performance on the Grammys this week was outstanding. I am still trying to process the imagery that he placed on television, and he stood in a space full of white people in front of white supremacy and said, I am not here for what you all are doing to my people. And for anyone who has a problem with listening to Black music and hearing our struggle, we are struggling right now. We're living in a time where we are getting killed left and right, and people are saying, why are you upset about it? So you're going to have to listen to that struggle in music.
What isn't explicit about Beyonce embracing all of the Blackness that has been gifted to her by her Creole mama, her Texas Bama Negro daddy? And I have to ask, why are we critiquing? I think it's so easy for us to critique Black women for the way that we choose to embrace and affirm and uplift our Blackness. I think it's so easy for us to tear down Black women because we live in a patriarchal society that is just as heteronormative and patriarchal as it is racist.
So
I want to play you a clip from the Saturday Night Live skit that's been shared so much. Let's take a listen to it first. This was where they were spoofing the response to the formation video.
The day Beyonce turned black.
Guys, I don't understand this new song.
Hot sauce in my bag swag? What does that mean? Maybe the song isn't for us.
But usually everything is!
It was the day white people lost their Beyonce.
So, Kate, I would never ask you to speak for all white people. but I am confused. I mean, Saturday Night Live is satiring a real thing. This really kind of almost visceral reaction some people had to the song and her performance. And I hope you can help me understand why.
You know, my best guess, based on kind of responses to the piece that I wrote, would be that she raised an issue and it empowered a lot of black people to have a conversation that perhaps they hadn't felt comfortable having. I mean, it became such a part of the zeitgeist. And I think what a lot of people want to do is assume that that black people are completely comfortable in their presence, that everything is fine. And when someone with the power that Beyonce has says everything is not fine, that turns a light back on us. And we have to ask ourselves, why is everything not fine? And I think that's a very uncomfortable place for people, and they can be either defensive. Now, I have to say, I heard from a lot of white women who said, yes, absolutely, I'm with you. And, you know, it wasn't all the angry people, but I think that's my best guess. I think this conversation is only going to continue to rise until our country is fully engaged with dealing with its past.
We're getting a number of tweets. We got this one from @TeddyAfroL. Personally, I couldn't care less. We are entitled to a moment of commemoration of our legacies, triumphs, and resistances. And we got one from Raw Dog Buffalo, @RawDogBuffalo, who says, seeing a light-skinned woman with straight hair in front of black women reminded me black skin, white mask, Fannin. I want to, for the African-Americans that are with me, I want to play this comment from Killer Mike. He's a rapper from Atlanta, and he's speaking here about the formation video with HBO's Real Time with Bill Maher. And it sounds like he's addressing not the white people that are upset. He's addressing the African-Americans who are upset.
She's talking to other black people saying, look, stupid, because I'm not at Ferguson when you want me to be doesn't mean I've sold you out. And then the rest of the first verse is about her telling other black people, I like being black. This is the type of black I am. I like the fact my daughter's black. I like my old Michael Jackson nose. I like my child with an afro. I like me. White people, that conversation wasn't even for you.
Regina, what kind of conversation has gone among African-Americans, who some of whom are not happy? It sounds like J. Michael wasn't entirely happy with this. How does that conversation go?
Oh, child. I mean, I think it's important, though. I'm not here for just one-sided Beyonce was awesome. I also feel like you need to shout out the issues that also came up in the video. I want to start there first. So with the video, you have Chantrell Patrice Lewis and you have Yaba Blay, who are talking about colorism and the issues with kind of like this one-sided idea of what Creolism means. And these conversations aren't including people who are part of that experience. And I really think that even now that I think about it, I really enjoy the fact that we're bringing up the fact that some of the people who are still in New Orleans, who are still dealing with the pushback against Katrina, were like, this is kind of a romantic notion of what happened after Katrina, and needs to have these other aspects included. With that being said, one of the issues that I don't have, and this is what Arielle was talking about, and I really agree with her, is that we refuse to acknowledge kind of like this gendered understanding of how we're trying to encompass what Beyonce is doing. And it's easy because it's always Beyonce, she's a mega mogul, right? We kind of forget the fact that, you know, hey, she's also a black woman who happens to be from the South. Like, that was my entry point into the conversation. Was I'm like, thank God we finally have some conversations going on about what Southern black womanhood looks like. And also the responses were led by women who were from the South. I was like, praise the Lord. Hallelujah. Okay. but I also think it's equally important to include the fact that there were aspects of the song in the video that were not meant for everybody. And I think that that's what's driving people up the wall is normally when we listen to Beyonce or see Beyonce visuals, there's something that everybody can somewhat embrace or be comfortable with. And then with this song and the lyrics, it's neither one. And because there's not a Rosetta Stone for understanding the Southern black womanhood that she is presenting, it's making people uncomfortable because she's not using traditional practices of Beyonce-dom, if you will. I mean, like, she created herself in a particular way. She's presented herself and sold herself in a particular way. And for her to step back from that, one, because she has, there's nothing else really, there's no other plateaus for her to climb. She's finally at a point where she can do this type of art and not have to be like, okay, I have to respond to every criticism, right, every critique. She can kind of just, you know, as Greg Tate said it really well, she can just put it out there and keep it moving and let everybody else have a panic attack about it.
Well, if I can. Go ahead, Ariel.
I was just going to talk about, I really agree with, as far as the conversations happening within the black community, as a Southern black woman, who's also a Southern black queer woman, who's also an activist on the front lines, like doing this work, got the receipts, been in this conversation for a long time. I think that there's a part of this conversation that is only for black women in the South, right?
Yes.
Like, I'm Atlanta till I die. I'm forever. I love Atlanta. My memories of Atlanta are Lowry hits MLK all day, right? Southwest Atlanta. And some of this stuff is really just for uplifting that sweet spot, that part of my history, that part of the black woman's legacy. And there are ways, I remember I knew as soon as Kendrick Lamar went on stage and did this beautiful
at the Grammys,
at the Grammys, and did this beautiful performance, that it would immediately be compared to Beyonce dropping this video. And I think that we should not be comparing the way that a black man talks about resistance to the way that black women talk about resistance, because the way that black show up is so multifaceted. It has to
be. We want to hear from all you out there listening as well. You can give us your thoughts on all of this. It's a lot. Tweet us at OST Talk. Join the conversation happening at facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. My guest right now, Ariel Marie of the Atlanta-based organization It's Bigger Than You. You just heard her voice. Also, Armstrong State University professor Regina Bradley, Cornell University student J. Michael Kinsey, and freelance journalist Kate Forrestal. J. Michael, I wanted to come back to you because I wanted to play the part of the Formation song that you say is problematic, which I assume is because of the lyrics. Let's listen. When it
get your song played on the radio station. I might get your song played on the radio station. You just might be a black Bill Gates in the making.
I just might be a black Bill Gates in the making.
I assume your problem isn't with Red Lobster. What's problematic about these lyrics?
I mean, we're talking about, you know,
biscuits.
This is gendered. No, you know, I love me a cheddar biscuit, but we're talking about gender this, gender that. And I'm like, okay, so we understand that gender is an issue. Black women are already over-sexualized. Black women are already placed in that position. Beyonce herself is placed in that position, you know. And so I'm like, oh, you're going to perpetuate that stereotype, you know, and it doesn't help. I mean, many people don't know this reference, but I'm told that, you know, this takes place in Storyville, which has a history with prostitutes and prostituting. So I'm just like, are you saying you're a pimp? Like, and that's fine. I think women should have the agency to do whatever they want with their bodies, but we have to also understand who's receiving this information. And I also want to go back to the to this other point, Beyonce, what the real issue is that Beyonce, like, has been positioned as this, you know, all-American black girl and what black folks should aspire to be. You know, we just want you to be pretty and to wear something skimpy and to dance real cute, you know. And I think it is wonderful that she showed that I'm more than that and I can do that. But we also keep going back to the song and to the video. And I'm like, well, what are we talking about? Because the song is doing something much different than the images in the video. And I'm just trying to understand, how are we to disconnect that? Because when I'm looking at water falling, the cop car falling, and I'm like, I slay. I'm like, what are we talking about? How is that slaying? What are we slaying, my dear?
Sounds like someone wants to answer.
So back to your comment about, you know, what are we trying to do here? Right before that, I really think that it doesn't have to be disconnected. It goes back to what that multifacetedness that Ariel was talking about. I can talk about having a great sex life. I can talk about rewarding you for giving me, great sex. But I can also tell you that this is what I'm doing in terms of my own agency. And I think the difference between women being hypersexualized is that she actually owns her sexuality in this instance. She's not the one that's on the receiving end. She's the one that's giving the reward. She's the one that's establishing the gauge for how sexuality should be rewarded. And I really think that the Storyville part is really fascinating as well, and not to take anything away from that aspect. But I really would hope that she would not put her daughter Blue Ivy in a whorehouse.
Yeah,
while she's having parlor.
Well, this
you
is
know
an interesting
saying?
Point. Okay, so we got this tweet from @GPB Lisa
image,
Clark.
Right?
Hang on one second. We got a tweet from Lisa who says, "Don't lose the patriarchy thread. Seems Bay is challenging the man in charge and not just the white man in charge." So we sadly have to end the conversation there, but I want to end on that thought to think that maybe what transcends race is the conversation about gender. So I want to say thank you to Armstrong State University Professor Regina Bradley, Ariel Marie of the Atlanta-based organization It's Bigger Than You, and Cornell University student J. Michael Kinsey, also freelance journalist Kate Forrestal, and encourage all of you out there to send us your responses as well. Thanks to all four of you.
Thank you for having us.
Former Georgia lawmaker Tyrone Brooks began serving a year-long prison sentence yesterday. Brooks pleaded guilty to tax fraud and no contest to mail and wire fraud. Prosecutors say the civil rights activist pocketed nearly $1 million in donations meant for charities he controlled. But Brooks told us last week that's not the full story.
The attack on me is about my work. It has nothing to do with money.
Brooks claims he's a target because of his efforts to solve a lynching case that dates back to 1946. When I pressed him about the charges against him, he said last week he's made mistakes, but believes there's still an ulterior motive to his prosecution.
People can see through the attack on me, and they can clearly see that, you know, if I was Jamie Dimon, a J.P. Morgan Chase, a Brian Moynihan, a Bank of America, look, this wouldn't be happening. So it's one count of tax fraud, which I pled guilty to, and all of the other no contest pleas were basically something that we could never agree with. My lawyers told me we will never, ever agree with the government accusation, so let's just plead to one tax count. I did that, one.
No matter how many times I asked Brooks the question, his answer was always the same. And that bothered listener Stan Brown of Macon. Brown left us this message.
You allowed this convicted felon to spin this wild fantasy without questioning him about it at all or having any kind of objective response. You could have had a journalist who covered his trial comment on his claims, but to air his claims without any kind of response at all is just an amazing fail for journalism.
And so we turn to Aaron Goldscheinen. He's a reporter with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and he covered the Tyrone Brooks case. He says there's no clear connection between Brooks' conviction and his investigation into the 1946 lynching.
He's not been able to provide any kind of evidence for that. We've never been able to find any kind of connection to somebody saying, hey, you know what, this Tyrone Brooks guy, he's making us look bad, let's take him down. Which is essentially what Tyrone is saying. is that he's being investigated for fraud because of his investigation into Morse Ford Bridge, making the FBI look bad.
Brooks says he will continue to pursue the investigation when he leaves prison.
We are not going to back away from this Morse Ford case, no matter what they do, no matter how many times they throw me in jail. This is not my first time going to jail. This is my 69th time, number 69.
But the AJC's Aaron Goldshinen says there's an important distinction between Brooks' earlier stints in jail and his current sentence.
Yeah, there's a difference between getting arrested for civil disobedience and getting arrested and convicted for fraud. There's a big difference. I mean, I'm sure it'll hurt his reputation. He'll still have that legacy as a great civil rights worker. You know, when the court and the U.S. Attorney's Office was bringing these charges and prosecuting him, they were careful to make sure that everyone knew that he had a long legacy of good works in Georgia, but that they couldn't overlook what he did in this case.
That's our show for today. But we always want to hear from you, and we'd love to get your opinions on this conversation about Beyoncé and really the reaction to Beyoncé. Time to move on? Is it just a pop song? Or is there actually something deeper going on here? And if you are offended by it, this is a safe space. Explain why. Tell us at 404-500-9457. You can also tweet us at OSTTalk or post your response to facebook.com/OnSecondThoughtRadio. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.